Hello, before we start the show, I wanted to send a quick message to those who are aiming to run the London Marathon next year. Now, I know the ballot places came out today, and I know lots of people have entered the championship race. And if you're lucky enough to have a place in 2020, then Shelter would really like to be part of their team. There's no minimum fundraising target when you have your own place. You just raise whatever you can, and you'll be joining a team of 200 runners who are together aiming to raise over £450,000. Now, obviously, running the marathon is a huge challenge, and this year, let's get running. And us will be aiming to provide coaching support. So we'll be providing training plans, and we're putting on a marathon workshop. We can attend and get some advice on how to approach the marathon from a training perspective, and also some fundraising tips from Shelter. On the day itself, obviously, there'll be lots of cheer points along the course to keep you going. And at the end of the race, there'll be a hero's welcome at the post-race reception. There'll be complimentary food, drinks, and that all-important post-marathon massage. Team Shelter really needs you this year. In the UK, it's estimated that every 19 hours, a person who is homeless dies. And it's not just those who are sleeping rough who are affected. Statistics estimate that more than 30% of deaths since 2017 have actually occurred where people were living in emergency or temporary accommodation. We desperately need to fight for more stable homes for families, older renters, and working people. And we need to give advice to people who don't know where to turn. Shelter needs your help to deliver this. So when you fundraise for Shelter, you'll be changing the lives of millions of people who suffer every year from bad housing or homelessness. You'll be making sure they have access to advice, support, and legal services they need. You're part of a movement which is fighting to make sure that one day no one needs to turn to Shelter for help. It's great if you can be involved. If you want to be part of Team Shelter, and you just want to, or you just want to find out a bit more information, then please email running@shelter.org.uk, and Helen will be there to help you. Now, on with the show. Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. There is no Caramel Kid. It's just me on my own, on my Todd today. So I'm not going to keep this very long. I'll just say that the interview today comes on the back of one of the most incredible weeks in the world of running. We've had the fastest known marathon time run by Eliud Kipchoge over in Vienna. He broke 2 hours. He ran 1:59:40. In the Ineos Challenge. We're going to chat about that in a sec. We had a world record in the women's race. We had, amazingly, Bridget Kiskoskaya ran 2:14:02, I think, was the official time, which is minutes or a minute and a half away from what Paula had previously run, which was seen as unassailable. So amazing races. And we want to talk about those and about the implications of what happened, and specifically about the shoes. So we're going to talk to Rich Blagrove. Now, Rich is a lecturer over at Loughborough in physiology, and he is an experienced S&C coach. I think he's coached in a variety of places, a variety of top Olympic athletes, and he's lectured on strength and conditioning throughout his career. So interesting to have his perspective on the impact of those shoes on running economy. So we're going to chat about that. Before we do that, I'll probably wait to the news. I don't want to witter on a couple of quick things about what's happened. Obviously, domestically, the cross-country season has started. We had an exciting race over in Cardiff, part of the British Cross Country Challenge, with female winners Charlotte Arter and male winners Mark Scott. So that's kicking off the season in style. Looking forward to how those guys are going to do the rest of the season. We had some quick half-marathon times. We had a husband, not husband and wife, partners, I guess, Lily Partridge and Ben Connor won their respective races at Manchester Half Marathon in quick times. We had some good racing at Birmingham on a shortened course. There was a suspicious package that rerouted the course there, which meant it wasn't quite as fast as we hoped. And the World Man Running Cup was the final race over in Ljubljana. Saw Mark Andrew Douglas, a good, great runner. He is the World Man Running Champion. He won the World Mountain Running Cup, and as did Irish Sarah McCormack. So congratulations to both of those guys. I should say a quick shout out. I'm probably forgetting loads of big races this weekend, but there's an England team went out to Rennes in France, and they had, in the women's race, a 1:23. Daniel Hodgkinson won, followed by Hannah Irwin of Fast Running. I write some great articles over there from Hannah. And our very own Let's Get Running's Hannah Viner. She came in third. She is the producer of a great email, if you want to pick that up. Some news from the world of running. Hannah produces that every Friday. So go on our site, letsgetrunning.co.uk/podcast, and you can sign up for Hannah's fantastic email. Great winners for the men as well. Shouldn't leave them out. Ollie Lockley was second. Jack Gray fourth. Owen Hines sixth. Alex Bampton eighth in the same competition. So nice one. Yeah, lots of stuff going on. Next week we'll be back to chat more about it when Jermaine's here. He'll be back from whatever he's doing. Busy shift, Extinction Rebellion, all that kind of stuff. He's getting involved with all that thing. But we'll chat it all next week. Sorry if I missed anything out. Here we go, Rich. Enjoy the interview. Hopefully you can give us some tips for the layman on how we can kind of improve our running economy without investing 250 quid in a pair of Nike trainers. So let's see what he has to say. There's no outro this week. So as always, if you like the show, please review us. Please share the show wherever you can. And we love reviews, as I said. Yeah, I've said that once, I'm going to say it again. It's hard doing this on my own. Anyway, here's Rich. Bye-bye. On today's show, we are talking to Rich Playgrove. Rich is, I'll introduce you now, Rich, before we launch into conversation, but you're a lecturer in physiology up at Loughborough and the director of the master's program in strength and conditioning. How are you doing?
Yep. Good, thank you. Thanks for inviting me on, Sean. It's great to be here.
Good stuff. And you're based over in Loughborough?
I am. I actually live about 60 miles away from there, but I won't bore everybody with stories about my commute, but it is quite a lot. It's quite a long way.
And it's quite an inspiring place to work. That's where a lot of the top junior athletes will come and train. I guess even some of the older senior athletes, if the funding program, you're dealing with or you're in contact with lots of kind of inspiring individuals, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't meant to be a sales pitch for Loughborough University, but yeah, we're ranked number one in the world for sports science related programs. So that's on the academic side. But yeah, as most of your listeners will probably know, it's very much kind of epicenter for elite sports. So there's a lot of the national governing bodies that are based on campus. And from a distance running perspective, we've got British Athletics based there and a lot of the funded athletes, and then students who are competing at a high level, university championships and so on. So yeah, it's a fantastic environment to work for sure.
Yeah. And with you, with your, I guess you have a history as a runner. You competed as a middle distance runner back in, I think we were spoke about this. Was it 2003 was the last time you properly competed as an athlete, but you carry on a little bit now.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't call myself a runner now, I don't think, but I was an undergraduate and a master's student at Loughborough again about 15 or so years ago now, so giving away my age there. And yeah, I competed at like a reasonable level, I guess, kind of regional, national type standards. I think around about 152 for 800 metres. And then actually when I left university, I got picked up by a talent identification program in rowing. And because I'm quite tall, it kind of, that sport suited me a little bit better. But my passion's always been with running. So when I stopped rowing, I just kind of run recreationally now, try and get out and do park runs on a Saturday. And a lot of the coaching work that I've done over the last 12 years has been with runners. So yeah. I've got a lot of contacts and my network's quite big within the running community. So I guess that's where I specialise.
So let's talk a bit about that. So you're working in an academic format. You've been lecturing for a while at a number of different universities. But also you mentioned you coached some various different people. What does that look like?
Yeah, so I got into academia in 2008 and started took up a lecturing position at St Mary's University. And again, many of your listeners will probably know that St Mary's used to be the sort of national centre for middle and long distance running. And that got moved away a few years after I started. But it's got very much a sort of tradition and culture associated with distance running. So I took up a post as a lecturer in strength and conditioning and quite quickly started doing some coaching work with some of the runners that were based at St Mary's. I was lucky enough to work with some really top-class athletes over the 9 years that I was based there, including several that competed at Olympic Games, a few that won medals at major international championships. So, I really enjoyed doing that for the time that I was there.
And was that specifically strength and conditioning coaching, or were you coaching holistically, looking at their training as well as their strength and conditioning on top?
Yeah, sorry, should have clarified. So that was strength and conditioning support for those runners. From a research perspective, I'm mainly an exercise physiologist, so I've done bits of work in the lab with runners as well.
Yeah.
Mainly from a research perspective, but the majority of the applied work I've done is strength and conditioning coaching.
Okay. And obviously this week's been a pretty major one in the world of running. And I thought it'd be good fun for us to sort of talk about kind of what's happened. Obviously this weekend just gone, we've had the Ineos sub 2 hour challenge, and then the following day in Chicago we had an incredible performance Bridget Koskay, if I can get it right. One is she broke Paul Radcliffe's marathon record by over a minute, and incredible. What did you think, like, looking at a specific look at probably the Ineos first, what do you think about that challenge? Were you captivated? But I guess from someone who's into research and someone who is maybe from a sort of a clinical background, was that kind of quite an inspiring event for you to watch?
First thing, both of those performances were just absolutely remarkable over the weekend. It was certainly a great weekend for distance running fans, for sure. And I think with Kipchoge's, it was, to some extent, it was expected. I think after his performance in Monza back in 2017, where he was 25 seconds short of breaking breaking the 2 hour mark, and then his world record in Berlin the following year, it was kind of somewhat expected, but he still had to obviously go out and do it. I guess for me, I'm sort of kind of caught in two minds with it, because like, I'm very much an athletics fan, so I kind of like to see good races between competitors, and I like seeing records being broken under legitimate conditions rather than these sort of contrived conditions created by big companies. But equally, at the same time, I'm a sports scientist, so I'm kind of fascinated by the limits of human performance and trying to push through barriers and so on. So I was really looking forward to it last week, and I was very much captivated during the 2 hours on the day.
Yeah. Well, what did they change from Monza? I'm trying to think of the specific factors that we'll go on in a minute, talk about the shoes and the change in those and what impact they've had. But did they change the corners? I read something about how they artificially manufacture the cambers to get the most out of each corner taking.
I think there were some subtle things done to the course. I saw a value of $20 million or something that was spent just on the course, which is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, my feeling on that is it probably didn't make a huge difference. Yeah. I think the main differences with Monza were they invited a crowd to the course in Vienna. So I think for Kipchoge in particular, he's somebody that responds to a crowd being there, and particularly when he's starting to get fatigued towards the end, it sort of helps push him on a little bit. So I think that probably made a little bit of a difference. I think the formation of the pacers, which sort of facilitated more effective drafting and reduced air resistance, was probably contributed a little bit. That was just slightly different to the Monza setup.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of other tweaks that he had with his sports science in terms of the way that he fueled his performance and the carbohydrate that he was taking on board. So I don't think it was one thing. I think kind of these little tweaks kind of accumulates to make up it was more than 26 seconds in the end. The 45 seconds that he improved.
And if we look at the Chicago, the Koskay performance, and that was just completely, I mean, I think no one really expected anything like that, because it wasn't even a paced race, was it, anything in Chicago? I think she was out there mostly on her own running those kind of times.
She had the benefit of being around other males that were competing in the race, but certainly, like you say, it wasn't the drafting formation that Kipchoge had. She obviously had to do quite a lot more of the work herself, and the pace was fluctuating up and down quite a bit more. And I know the first 5 kilometers was crazy quick.
I think
she was on for about 2 hours 10 or something.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah,
5K.
Yeah.
So it was absolutely phenomenal performance, and I mean, you sort of see things on social media that really put it into context around. Like it was 5 minutes and 4 seconds per mile that she was running, and I think her average 5K time was quicker than any female has ever run a park run before, and it's kind of crazy statistics like that that really sort of put it into context for us.
Yeah, crazy. And what I think is the biggest shame about that is we can't see anything like that without immediately being a little bit suspicious. It's a sad place we're kind of in. Yeah. As soon as something like that since we see a performance like this, we're immediately thinking, that can't be right. And you see hundreds of things on Twitter about, and I guess we have to challenge these things because we have to make sure that what we're seeing we can believe. But it is a shame that the immediate reaction in most places is, oh my God, look at Bridget's progression in performance, and this can't be right. It's sad for us as
well. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think with Alberto Salazar being banned by USADA for 4 years, that's very much fresh in everybody's minds. So the World Championships finishes, that story's obviously made the headlines a lot. And the following weekend, somebody runs sub 2 hours for a marathon and somebody knocks over 80 seconds off a world record, which was kind of perceived by many to be untouchable.
Yeah.
And so straight away, or quite naturally, I guess, a lot of athletics fans immediately are a little bit sceptical and suspicious around performances like that, which I think is normal.
And but the other big issue, kind of, I guess, I was going to say the other doping, is doping on the feet, is these shoes. Something about how in the last 13 months, five of the fastest marathons of all time have been run in a version of Nike's Vaporfly. Do you know, like, for me, I know they have carbon fiber plates and there's some quite fancy foam in there. Do you know what they do? Do you know how these changes in this carbon fiber leads to these improvements in efficiency?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not a material engineer and certainly don't work for any shoe company, but I've spoken to quite a lot of the athletes that I provide either coaching or do consultancy with, and they're obviously really interested in it because for a lot of them that either aren't supported by Nike or don't have access to the Nike shoes, they sort of perceive it as quite a big disadvantage for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like you're alluding to, I mean, trainers for quite a long time have had carbon fiber plates in them. There was a trainer called the Adistar, I think, that was brought out in the just after 2000 that had a carbon fiber plate in it. And so there's been variations of that sort of thing around for nearly 20 years. And equally with the foam that's in the Nike Vaporflies, there's been different types of foam which have been used a long time and have been purported to provide benefits to running performance.
Yeah, like the Adidas, was it the Boost that suddenly everybody started doing the copying Adidas with the almost like polystyrene style look soles? That was kind of the big thing about 5 years ago. So I guess it kind of comes in roundabouts. Like that.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there's been various different fads. I mean, there was a phase around sort of 2010-ish where everybody was wearing like the five finger Vibrams and running barefoot, and the minimalist shoe was kind of seen to be the next big thing. But that's kind of gone away now, or at least been proven to probably be not as effective as we first thought. But there seems to be three things with the Nike Vaporfly which are offering quite a big advantage compared to other shoes. So the first one, as you mentioned, is the carbon fiber plate. Although it's in a lot of other shoes, There's something about the geometry of the plate that's in the Vaporflies which seems to be offering quite a bigger benefit. So it seems to be that because of its stiffness and its shape, it's got quite a sort of curved shape. It's decreasing the amount of work that's occurring at the metatarsal phalangeal joints, which is basically a fancy way of saying the joints between the bones of the midfoot and some of the bones of the toe. And that essentially means that the plate kind of acts as a bit of a lever and saves some of the work around the foot and the ankle.
Right.
But it doesn't seem to be that's giving the biggest benefit. There's definitely some advantage there, but it's actually the midsole foam that seems to be giving best advantage. So Nike have somehow managed to come up with like a sort of mixture of chemicals, and they've got kind of long words. I think it's abbreviated to PEBA, the type of foam that they're using. But it's compared to other types of foam, so like the EVA and the TPU types of foam that are traditionally used in other trainers, it seems to be a lot more lightweight. So it hasn't got the kind of extra mass associated with it. And it's much more compliant. So essentially what I mean by that is if you squash it, it kind of springs and pings back. And so the energy that's being stored in the foam as the foot lands essentially gets returned very, very quickly, and that's kind of used to propel the runner further forward.
Right, okay.
And there's been some quite quite tidy studies actually, which have been published in the academic literature, showing that it's about 32% more efficient. This is the foam.
Wow.
And so when you start increasing the thickness of that, so you compare it to so most trainers or most racing flats are something around, I think, 20 millimeters thickness, and the Vaporfly is 31 millimeters. So that kind of extra thickness is probably accounting for most of the energy saving that's occurring. And the trainers that Kipchoge was wearing, which seemed to be a prototype of the next percent. So this is kind of the next model up from the Vaporflies. They're apparently more like 50 millimeters, which is essentially like a platform shoe.
Right.
like it's just an enormous midsole thickness. So when you combine the foam material with how thick it is, you can kind of see that it's essentially acting like a spring.
Right.
And he's able to bounce from stride to stride without losing barely any energy at all.
Wow. And it is funny that I hadn't really thought about the comparison with these minimalist shoes that, you know, 10 years ago, everyone was trying to cut as much foam as they possibly could out the bottom of a trainer. And now it looks like it's going the other way and you're sticking as much spring as you possibly can just to try and gain a bit of a performance advantage.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I guess one good thing about these Nike shoes is there has been some studies published in the academic literature, which one that was funded by Nike. So people sort of immediately assume, well, the data's, I don't know, kind of been fabricated a little bit, or they've cherry picked the results to make it look as beneficial as they can. But there's two other studies which had like no association with Nike whatsoever.
Yeah.
And they're all finding very, very similar things. So we've got three papers published, which all show that they're often an advantage of somewhere between about 3% and 4% in terms of running economy.
Wow.
Which at an elite level translates to something around 2-2.5% in terms of performance speed.
Wow.
Which at an elite level is really significant. It's a huge amount. We're not talking about, yeah, like fractions of a percentage. Like 2-2.5% is a big difference.
And is it like the rules suggest that like the shoe should be available, I guess, to everybody? The IAAF have these very it's not particularly punchy, it's not particularly clear, but there are rules to say that everybody should have the same advantage and it should be reasonably available to all, I think is the exact phrasing. Is it fair to have these shoes? Do you think that there's the controversy about it and almost like the negativity surrounding it now? Is it fair?
Yeah.
Or should there be? Should we be worried about it? Should we be making a stand against the kind of this shoe arms race in a way?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. There seems to have been a lot of debate about this week, and seems to be quite polarized. Like people either think, yep, they should definitely be banned. It's not fair, and it's breaking the IAAF rules and so on. Other people think, well, it's just sort of a natural evolution of the way technology influences sport. So
yeah,
it should definitely be allowed. And I sort of sit on the fence a little bit with this because, yeah, on one hand, the Vaporflies are available to everybody. And I think the next percents are out now as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like they're pricey, but anybody can buy them.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably the reason that I think Koskai was wearing either the Vaporflies or the Next Percent. I'm not sure which one it was, but they were certainly available to other people. But then you sort of hear things around that, so Kipchoge and maybe maybe Koskai, they were wearing kind of bespoke type designs. So the curvature of the carbon footplate was potentially more suited to their foot shape, for example.
Yeah.
Which then does contravene the rule. And yeah, I think Kipchoge's prototype isn't going to be released until March, April next year. The Alpha Fly or whatever it's called. So yeah, that certainly is a little bit unfair. It's difficult to compare anything against a shoe that other people can't get hold of.
Is this going to get to a point then, I guess, when you have to almost declare your trainers? Or, you know, I think that Laura Muir had some kind of hybrid spikes that she was on, a hybrid prototype spikes she was wearing at this year's World Championships. Is it going to be a case where they're engineering these shoes to such a degree that before big races and championships, they'll have to almost like monitor everyone's footwear before they allow them to race? Will it ever get to that sort of situation?
I think I think if it was good, if the IWF were going to do something, they probably would have done it a couple of years ago. Because as you're kind of suggesting with these stats from race results and so on, and I mean, the New York Times did quite a comprehensive analysis, and it's, yeah, it's not an academic paper, but I think they had 50,000 results or something from various different marathons. People had declared what their shoes were, and they found some really interesting trends around, like, the number of people setting PBs in the Vaporflies. Like, it's just gone through the roof.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think really something should have been done a couple of years ago. And the fact that the IAAF haven't done anything, and like you're saying, it's now filled onto the track with spikes and so on and so forth. I wonder whether they are going to take a stand and sort of change anything. Like, maybe these performances over the last weekend will make them sort of reconsider and set up some sort of commission or board that that considers the data and some of the academic research that's out there and decides whether it's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the most important thing with this for me is we don't know what other companies are doing and what they're developing. And so people are kind of citing, like, Hoka's equivalent of this, New Balances, Asics, like a company called On, have got an equivalent racing flat. And those have never been compared against the Vaporfly, or been tested in a laboratory-based setting, and then the data published quite transparently.
Yeah,
and so we don't really know what advantages those types of racing flat are offering. The only comparisons which have been done are the Nike Vaporfly against other types of Nike trainer and the Adidas Boost, and so we don't really know what other companies are up to. So I guess if they can develop the technology to bring themselves to the level of the Vaporfly, it sort of makes it fair.
Yeah.
But then you are into a bit of an arms race, as you described it.
Yeah. And also, obviously, Nike sponsor the top athletes. Therefore, you're more likely to see the Vaporfly on, you know, Kipchoge's the greatest marathon runner in the world, or potentially greatest marathon runner there's ever been. He's obviously wearing the Nike. So it's more evident, you know, that
yes,
issue and that sort of thing. But also they do have so much, their market advantage is so great. It will be hard for other than Adidas, I guess, to try and bridge that gap. It's going to be an interesting couple of years, probably.
Yeah, I agree. And again, because Nike brings so much money into the sport, like, the IAAF are probably a little bit reluctant to look at it too closely, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm sure Seb Coe, I think Seb Coe was on the payroll of Nike at some stage. I think he's definitely been an advisor. So the likelihood of Seb Coe of it standing out and doing anything like that is probably pretty slim. I was thinking of myself of doing it, you know, with this Salazar and that, all these kind of things, and obviously Lance Armstrong, Nike backed him to the hilt until it was the last minute and things. I was thinking of doing a Nike boycott and never buying Nike shoes again. But then if I'm immediately putting myself at a disadvantage by not allowing myself to wear the best shoes in the market, I don't know whether to go for my principles or my desire to run fast times. It's quite,
well, exactly. And it comes back to what we spoke about before, that I think at this point in time and over the last 2 years, like, elite runners especially, they know it's not a level playing field. Like, if you take 20 or 30 runners that are on the start line for a marathon in the elite field, like, the variability in performance, so physiological measures and finish times in that 20 or 30 is smaller than the variability you're seeing in the trainers.
Wow.
And so essentially, if you've got 5 or 6 Nike-sponsored athletes in that field of 20 or 30, they're going to be the 5 or 6 that cross the line first, because you're getting this 4% advantage in terms of running economy, which, as I say, translates to 2.5% in performance. So that puts them, a minute and a half further up the road. And so this is what people are arguing, that, the world record for the men's marathon improved by, I think it's just under 4 minutes in 28 years. And in the last 3 years, it's come down by nearly the same amount.
Wow.
And that's obviously primarily Kipchoge that's taken that time off. But a lot of it can be explained by the performance advantage that the trainers are affording to the athlete.
Yeah. I've heard some stories, I can't remember where I read it, about guys that were sponsored by different brands actually just put the Vaporflies on and painted them and then drew.
I've heard this as well, that athletes are recognising it. And I mean, it's not a placebo, because when you, like, if you think about an elite runner, how many different types of trainers that they've tried, and every time they put a new pair of trainers on, there is the expectation that it's going to make them feel quicker and maybe prevent injury or whatever, particularly if the company are telling them that. So they put the Vaporflies on, like, as far as they're concerned, it's just another pair of running shoes. But like elite athletes are saying, but like it feels like I've got springs on my feet.
Yeah.
And so if they're all saying that and you've got an athlete that isn't sponsored by Nike, then they're going to want to get hold of those shoes. And if it means painting them and sticking like their sponsor's brand over the top, then that's the lengths people are going to.
it all seems a shame that it is money. Money is again dominating sport, and it's a shame it's kind of going. I remember I think it was a couple of Olympic cycles ago, they were saying that more American and British middle distance runners were competing internationally, and it was showed that it was less sort of medals were won by more by money than it was by anything else. I think that was quite a dangerous trend.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And it's a shame that kind of, although it's on a, you know, it's Kenyan guys or guys from anywhere that can get these Vaporflies, provided they're sponsored by Nike. It's a shame that the money of Nike, again, is dominating the sport. And so medals are decided by investment by a large company. It's quite a sad thing to admit.
Yeah, it is a little bit, yeah.
But I guess one good thing, watching sort of Doha, and I saw some photos of Kipchoge's strength and conditioning routine in the lead up to this event, and it was the guys digging a deep like a big ditch so they could then do this drill routine using this ditch and things. And it's, although we do think that money dominates the medal tables and performances, it's good to see that actually good old-fashioned hard works. It's still, Kipchoge is still the greatest marathon runner we've seen. He's still an incredible athlete
absolutely.
And it's important we don't necessarily like lose sight of that. So it's I think that's one of the worst things about kind of this debate about solely on the shoes is he is still a great athlete. Like you said, there's such a small performance difference between all these athletes at the top, and they're all incredible athletes. It's a shame that technology is I guess substituting for, you know, a pure athletic achievement. I kind of wanted to move the conversation on to a little bit to kind of your research and your work over the years with different athletes. And so you do a lot of research into how strength and let's say best like exercises and based interventions and the impact they have on running economy. Like a lot of our listeners will be guys running cross country to marathon, and other than going out and buying these Vaporflies, is there for them? What do you think? If you're short on time, if they've not got a lot of cash, they're largely focusing just getting out and running. Is there, what would you say is one sort of effective investment they can make in their performance? It can be either sort of the time they spend or money. What would you suggest to someone in that position?
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, just taking a step back for a second. Yeah, my PhD was looking at the effects of strength training on middle and long distance running performance. And as part of that, I did a review of the academic published literature that has investigated any training intervention studies that have used strength training as a replacement or a supplement to running training. And the majority of the literature is kind of suggesting that it does seem to have a benefit. And again, it seems to benefit this parameter known as running economy.
So I've
mentioned that a few times as part of this conversation, so it's probably worth defining it just really briefly for your listeners.
So
running economy is essentially the amount of oxygen or energy that's being used at any sub-maximal running speed. So again, for something like a marathon, it's incredibly important. So the less oxygen or the less energy that a runner is using, the more economical that they are. And it's also got big correlations right the way down to sort of 8 and 1500 meter performance, so the full spectrum of middle and long distance events. It seems to improve economy. So therefore, translates quite nicely to an improvement in performance. And so the way that runners probably best incorporate this, like if we, just from a pure scientific perspective, it seems that 2 or 3 strength training sessions a week over a period of about 2 or 3 months result in a substantial lowering of running economy.
Wow.
And so that's kind of the scientific answer, I guess. So as within those sessions, you don't necessarily need to be doing a really high volume of work, particularly if you've not done very much strength training before, but something between 6 to 10 sets of lower limb work, so resistance training for the legs, would probably be sufficient. And if you can manage to incorporate a couple of those types of sessions a week,
yeah,
then it should be, you should feel a benefit to your performance within 2 or 3 months.
Okay. So it can be as little as half an hour's of exercises, bodyweight exercises at home would do that job if you weren't accustomed to it.
Yeah. So getting into a bit more detail. So how you kind of organize that and integrate it into the week, like for me, and now I'm sort of talking, I guess, a bit more as a coach, very much depends on the athlete. And so most of the scientific publications will use weight training in a sort of gym based setting, and it will be lifting barbells, dumbbells, like kettlebells perhaps. But if a runner doesn't have access to that type of equipment or isn't willing to pay a gym membership, which is obviously completely reasonable, then there are some things that you can do in the comfort of your own home to replace those types of exercises. Like how far you can kind of progress with that type of stuff is a bit more debatable. So at some point you probably do need to start loading, but again, you can sort of use implements around the home or your imagination with the way in which you're adding some external load to the body. And so like I've programmed for runners to do strength type work at home quite a few times before, and it seems to be quite effective.
Okay. And kind of that kind of leads me on a little bit to my next kind of question, which is like, for me, I do try and do those two sessions a week, and I generally I'll sit and I'm with my coach, I'm thinking over a period of time about the my progression of my training, and I'll think, you know, I've got those two sessions a week, and I'll keep moving those through the whole season. I don't tend to think about too much about how that progresses and how I almost periodize that training over the period. Is that important? Do I need to think about the progression of my training and of my strength training, and do I need to think about in different parts of the season I should be doing different types of training really to get the most out of it?
Yeah, I think for runners, I don't think being like really methodical and mega scientific about the way in which you're kind of planning training over an entire year is particularly necessary.
Right.
I think if you're from a strength trained sport, so you take like a rugby player for example, who's obviously got higher levels of absolute strength, like it probably is quite important that you be a bit more thoughtful with the way that you plan and program.
Yeah.
What is important is that every sort of 4 to 6 weeks, you're varying something about the way in which you're kind of challenging the body.
Right.
And so like typically when I'm programming for runners around this kind of time of year, so for a sort of traditional year plan where the target's some point in the summer as on the track, I would usually be doing kind of like capacity building work where we're trying to build up some strength and resilience around key muscles and tissues which are likely to be vulnerable to injury.
Okay.
So particularly things like the Achilles, the feet, the calf muscles, some stuff around the trunk and the core is really important as well.
Yeah.
And as part of that, just kind of learning technique on some key exercises, which I then intend on using as kind of as key strength exercises for the next phase.
Okay.
So then around Christmas, go on.
I was going to say, in capacity, by that, do you mean a simpleton like me, do you mean like quite a heavy weight and shorter reps, or was it more, like you said, the technique and learning how to do those exercises with lower weights and short and longer reps?
Yeah, so with the... So building capacity in specific tissues, I mean like fairly high repetition ranges. So
right.
Around sort of 15 or so repetitions per set, relatively short recovery. And you can even organize exercises as in a kind of circuit type format. And so they're being stressed through a number of different exercises and sets in succession.
Right.
Whereas on the more sort of multi-joint type exercises like your squats, your deadlifts, step-ups and lunges, I'd probably lower the repetition range a little bit. And then once the technique and the skill has been mastered, we can start adding some load. And so I'd probably work somewhere around 8 to 12 repetitions for that initially.
Right. Okay.
So that would kind of be the focus up until, I guess, just before Christmas for a track athlete.
Okay. And then they start to then pick up the weight a bit and drop those repetitions down.
Yeah, so I'd usually then keep a little bit of capacity work going on in the background, so still working like specific areas of the body, but start to increase the intensity a little bit, and even start to incorporate like some low-level plyometrics around that time, which essentially just preparing the body for doing higher intensity plyometrics just before track season.
Okay. Okay. And with that, because you're doing a lot of, I looked at some of the research you're doing, you're doing quite a lot of research about plyometrics in your athletes. I know, I'm told, go out and do your drills and I kind of know what the benefit is. I know that at the end of the day is I'm trying to improve running economy, but what's important about plyometrics? Why should we be doing those? And what has your research told you about the benefits of them?
So plyometrics, I mean, compared to resistance training, they're that little bit more specific. And so you can kind of feel that when you do a series of, I don't know, A skips or even double foot jumping, hopping and bounding and these sorts of things, like movement pattern wise and the forces that you're generating, like they're that little bit more similar to running than compared to sort of weight room type activity. So you've got the kind of specificity and the carryover into the skill that you want to transfer the qualities to.
Right.
But I mean, what's going on in terms of the sort of science is you're essentially encouraging your tendons and connective tissue, so particularly the Achilles tendon, to store and return more energy. So every time your foot hits the ground, so your connective tissue and your tendons have essentially got a really high capacity to store energy as they lengthen. But that energy is wasted quite quickly if we spend a long time on the ground, or our tendons just aren't very good at returning that energy once they start to shorten.
Right.
And so by doing plyometrics, you're developing and training that particular quality.
Okay.
And so that obviously then helps things like running economy in terms of our physiology.
Yeah.
And there's probably a little bit of an argument that they offset risk of injury as well. There's not quite as much convincing evidence for that.
Yeah.
But the sort of specific loading on tissues obviously stimulates response. And so we get an improvement in kind of density and resilience of connective tissue.
Okay.
And it might also improve things like bone mineral density as well, which reduces the risk of stress fractures. So, yeah, plyometrics are probably helping reduce risk of injury.
And we all, you know, most of my listeners, well, I'm talking for myself really, but I'm sure a lot of guys are like me. We tend to, we'll go down the track, we'll do a couple of the odd, you know, like you say, A skips or B skips or whatever, and then we'll go and do our session. Is that the most effective way of doing plyometrics? Should we be, you know, integrating them into a strength training session? Would it be better to do them in a session on their own? Where can we get the most benefit from those different activities?
Yeah, it's a great question that, and this sort of relates to what I was talking about before, that the way in which I organize strength and conditioning into the training week for a runner very, very much depends on the runner actually. And so if we just go off the science evidence, we say, well, just do two or three sessions a week of resistance training and plyometrics. But the like where you place that around your running is much, much more individual. And so to use your example, for somebody that's got a busy lifestyle, so they maybe work 9 till 5, or it's a young athlete that goes to school or college, like people have got families, people have got busy social lives, like there's a lot going on in people's lives. So if you tell them, well, you need to go down to the gym 3 times a week on top of your normal running, it's just completely unrealistic. And so for runners like that, what I tend to do is divide up the strength and conditioning into what I term kind of training units rather than training sessions. And so you end up kind of microdosing different types of strength training through the week. And so to use your example, if you want to integrate some plyometrics, like putting it in as part of a warm up before you do a hard interval training session would probably be quite a good place to do it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. You're likely to get benefits. If it's a more elite athlete that's maybe working part time or can dedicate much more time to their training, they'll spend an hour and a half doing strength and conditioning, and a part of that session will be plyometrics. And
right.
So they position it in a different place in the week. So there's not a kind of right or wrong answer in terms of where to put it. Like I wouldn't do it after runs.
Okay.
Just because of the sort of damage that you've incurred by doing a run and the fatigue that's in your system, going to do something quite intense like plyometrics would potentially be quite risky.
Yeah.
But doing it as part of an S&C session or before a run seems very logical to me.
Yeah. Okay. And we should mention your book at this stage. You've written a book about, I've forgotten the title again. It's about strength and conditioning.
Yes. Yeah. It's called Strength and Conditioning for Endurance Running, and
a simple name I should have remembered. Yeah, that's exactly what we need. Yeah.
Yeah. It came out in, I think, 2015. Yeah. Was it? And I essentially wrote it. Like, the main motivation was, with the work that I was doing with runners at St. Mary's, so in and around London, I was getting quite a lot of inquiries from coaches and athletes who were based, well, around the whole UK, really.
Mm.
Some who wanted to come down for screening and consultancy type sessions. And I just didn't really have the capacity at the time to offer advice and do sessions with lots of athletes.
Mm.
And so I just found myself sending lots of advice out via email and sometimes over the telephone. And so I thought, yeah, I'll just write a book on it. sounds like a ridiculous thing to do, but it sort of served its purpose, I think, because it's very practical. So there's lots of pictures, there's lots of information about how to execute exercises with appropriate technique, and there's some quite lengthy descriptions around like typical errors and mistakes that people make and how to go about correcting them.
Yeah.
So hopefully for coaches and runners that don't want to get bogged down with the sort of science and the mechanisms and so on, it's quite useful and practical.
Yeah, and with that kind of thinking about, we spoke a bit off air about sort of the importance of coaches. Do you think it's often hard, obviously, when you're doing it on your own? I'm in my front room here, and I'm doing a few exercises of an evening. It's hard to know really how what I look like, whether my technique is good, that sort of thing. How important is your coach in helping you put together this strength training plan? Should it be something we consult somebody else about in order to integrate it properly?
Yeah, it's obviously incredibly useful, and yeah, it's valuable to consult with a qualified strength and conditioning coach, and ideally one that's got some background in working with distance runners and kind of knows the stresses of the sport and what runners go through and the issues and barriers that runners face in terms of injuries and so on.
Yeah,
so it's definitely helpful and something that I would recommend. I mean, again, if people don't want to invest in that, or they can't afford it, or they can't find access to somebody that's got an appropriate qualification, then sticking with some of the basic exercises and finding a resource, I guess, like my book or something online, is the next best option. But there's nothing that can kind of replace a coach being there and correcting movement and helping you progress the training, your training in an appropriate way.
Yeah, and I've got kind of one more question before I let you sort of get back to work. Like, I noticed you're also doing a bit of work on the low energy availability, or the consequences of low energy availability on physical performance and health biomarkers in endurance athletes. Now, obviously, with me having a young baby and training and working and that sort of thing, that's kind of quite a topic that's kind of close to
stressful.
And obviously it goes without saying that tired athletes don't get as much out of their training as those who are rested and ready to go. But from my perspective, what sort of biomarkers, and for others in a similar position, what sort of biomarkers should we all be keeping an eye on in order for us to see when we are kind of at this position where we have low energy and it's going to affect our training? Is there sort of specific triggers we should be looking out for that might, and how do we look for those triggers?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So this is an area that my research is starting to move into, because most of it so far is focused on performance outcomes.
Mm.
So just how do we get runners faster, basically? And there's obviously a lot of issues that runners face associated with health. So injury being the main one, but also, as you're alluding to here, relative energy deficiency in sport, or it's previously been known as the female athlete triad for females.
Mm.
is really prevalent, particularly at a kind of well-trained and an elite level.
Mm.
And so, yeah, some of my research is moving into, okay, what types of blood, so hematological markers, like markers in the immune system and hormones, might be the most sensitive to picking up. So, like, unfortunately, a lot of this is quite lab-based. So we'll like by the end of the program of research that we've currently got going, we'll hopefully have some answers around like practical things that runners can do.
Mm.
So what we're really talking about is measuring things like estrogen with females, thyroid hormones, like appetite hormones, perhaps, and testosterone with males.
Yeah.
So it's obviously things that runners at the clubs and just every day can't really be measuring. So to answer your question, I mean, for females, the main sort of barometer of low energy availability or kind of energy status is the menstrual cycle. Mm. And so like I'd strongly encourage female runners to be tracking their menstrual cycle with either a diary or an online app that there's quite a few that you can use that are really useful.
Mm.
And so looking at like fairly consistent lengths of menstrual cycle, and it's also really important to check that ovulation is occurring, because you can have a normal menstrual cycle pattern but without ovulation occurring, which could be a cause of low energy availability. Mm. So it's, I guess it's a bit easier for females because that's quite an accurate marker, whereas for males, like, you've really got to be thinking about or reflecting on, like, whether your libido's the same between various different training cycles, whether you just kind of generally feel low on energy, or your mood's kind of fluctuating quite a lot. And if you're picking up a lot of niggles and sort of coughs and colds, so upper respiratory tract type infections, that can also be a bit of a red flag. So
yeah,
there's a few things there which are hopefully can be applied quite easily by some of your listeners.
Yeah.
And there's also a couple of questionnaires out there as well. So there's questionnaire called the Low Energy Availability for Females questionnaire, which seems to be quite valid. There's not a male equivalent at the moment, but I believe that one will be validated quite soon.
Yeah.
So, a couple of quite practical things that people can use.
Yeah. Okay. Wicked. And we'll look out for the research when it comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I'll certainly post it on social media and try and get it into some mainstream media as well.
Good stuff. And actually, I have three final questions we ask to all of the people we interview, all our interviewees, and they're quick fire.
These are always the hardest.
These are the hardest ones, yeah. And the first one is, if you could be running anywhere now, where would it be?
Wow. I really like running on trails, like off-road in forests. I guess the natural answer is somewhere warm, but I generally don't like running in places that are too hot and humid. I tend to suffer quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, so somewhere in a forest, off-road, I think, on trails, flat as well, nowhere too hilly.
The second question is, can you recommend us things? We've recommended your book already, but can you recommend anything else to our listeners? Could be book or film, could be a piece of equipment, or it could be an experience.
I think from a strength and condition perspective, yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to sort of sell my book or anything, but that's obviously it's a useful resource.
Yeah.
I think if people want to do strength training at home, then investing in like some resistance bands, which aren't too expensive, is something I often encourage if people haven't got access to a gym facility and don't want to pay membership and so on. Like if you can get two or three resistance bands, which are varying in tension, so how stiff they are,
yeah,
then it's kind of a quite easy way to start adding some load in the comfort of your own home without having to put a books in a rucksack or something like that.
And our final question is, in your opinion, it may have changed after this weekend, what's been the greatest endurance performance of all time?
Yeah, that's another really good question. I think Paula Radcliffe's always stuck in my head. Mm. And certainly when I was a runner back in early noughties, or a competitive runner rather, back in the early noughties, I was always absolutely amazed by Bikili's doubles at the World Cross Country Championships.
Yeah,
I think he did it, I think it was either six or seven times in a row.
Yeah, crazy.
It was just absolutely phenomenal year after year. And they used to have the short course and the long course. it went on back-to-back days, and those sort of always stick in my head as phenomenal feats of endurance performance over quite testing terrain.
Yeah, and always looked so incredible while doing it, which is always the
absolutely
thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's a good one.
Incredibly efficient. Yeah,
that's the first one that time it's come up. But actually, it's one of I'd kind of forgotten myself, but it was a pretty good one. Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for your chatting. I know I've kept you a long time, Rich, but it's all been really good stuff, and good luck with the rest of your research, and look forward to hearing. I'll put some links to your book on the show notes, but also in your social channels for people to look out for that research when it comes out.
Great. Thanks for inviting me on, Sean.
Always good to chat. Thanks, Rich.